agenda.
Is there anyone who does not have a handout? I don't see, it doesn't look like you have a handout. We just want to make sure that they won't have one. But it's... It looks like this, it's a page, three pages. Just give it a minute or two. I think he's printing some more. I believe that he's printing some more. No, I'm just saying he's setting the camera up and everything like that. Yeah. You guys can share this. I have it on my computer.
Huh? 20 minutes.
20.
Because we've got that's a frack hole.
I have a little chance. Let's see.
Okay.
Is there anyone who needs a handout?
Three pages. Also, the new camera's not working great, so speak loud.
Is this good?
It might pick me up.
Okay.
Speak loud enough.
Okay, I'll try. Yeah, 3 pages, okay. Ready to roll?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm almost ready to roll. Just have to open the document here. Okay. So, greetings, nice to be back here. Hello, everyone. And as the title states, we're going to speak about the progression of soul stages and the journey to the divine. We'll see what that means in a minute. Now, you see in the left-hand column, I have 4 types, if you go down from page 1 to page 2. The first type is called the daughter or princess. The second type is called the Hebrew bondswoman. The third type, going to the next page, is called the Hebrew bondsman. And the fourth one is called the Canaanite bondsman. Now, this is an old tradition, although not mentioned explicitly in the discourses that I'm basing myself on here. This is an old tradition going back to the Zohar, Zoharic literature. There's a section called the Saba, the old man, the old sage, or not actually sage, the old man, in the Torah reading of Mishpatim, that deals with laws. Now, this is after the great moment at Mount Sinai, after the great revelation, after God spoke the theophany. The next section in the Torah actually gives very detailed civil law and all sorts of nitty-gritty details, legalistic details. And it opens up with a section on bondsmen, bondswomen, slaves, in other words. But slavery is a very regulated, so I don't want to use the word slaves because that may give certain connotations that I don't want to imply. But basically, there are various, and there's a whole discussion in the Zoharic literature how this represents the various types of people, slaves, bonds people, described and derived from that piece of the Torah. Actually describes various relations in that a person, individual, can have with God at various stages. Different people can have different relations at various stages of life. An individual can pass through different relations with God. And you notice I have arrows pointing down. So the highest one here is the princess, the daughter of the king. the great person who's not in a state of being a slave or a bonds person to God, but is actually more like a child to God, has a certain intimacy, a certain loftiness. And then I have three arrows pointing down from there, and then I go down to, so let's look from the bottom up, from the Canaanite bondsman. That's the person who's the most distant from God. And so every day, really, or through our lives, each one of us maybe passes through these various states. And maybe in the morning, when we wake up, and we haven't really contemplated very much, and haven't done any interior work yet, maybe we start off in our relationship with God doing it, if we do it at all, if we do anything for God at all, we do it out of the sense of guilt, of duty. We're not really interested. But the idea is that we can progress. We can move up. As you see, we start at the bottom, and we move up from there to the next stage, which is not a Canaanite bondsman, but a Hebrew bondsman. It was a little bit... So the idea would be the Canaanite bondsman. One of the laws discussed in the about a Canaanite bondsman, what if the master hits the Canaanite bondsman with a rod? What are the laws? What sort of responsibility does the master have? How responsible can the master be held? What if the Canaanite bondsman dies because of that? So the master would have committed a capital offense and would be responsible for having killed this bondsman, etc. So, but from there, there's derived the idea that this is a person with whom the relationship consists of force. Things have to be done by force, either external force or sometimes internal force, guilt. Sense of conscience, guilty conscience, inner compulsion. But we can move up from there. We can move up to the stage higher. We can become Hebrew bondsmen rather than Canaanite bondsmen. The Canaanite were the people who lived in the land before they, when the family of Jacob left and went down to Egypt for those several hundred years. The Canaanites were living in the land. But then when the Jacob's family returned to the land, there were the Hebrews. They're supposed to be the great people, the people who encountered God. People are on somewhat of a higher level. So the Hebrew bondsman would mean someone who is a step higher, someone who has some innate or some deeper connection with God. And the way described is that this person mediates between the outside and the inside. The Canaanite bondsman works out in the field, doesn't really belong in the home. But the Hebrew bondsman mediates between the two. He brings things from the field into the home, brings the raw produce. So it's a step becoming more interior, moving closer to God. And we'll then a person can progress up even higher than that, one step up. The Hebrew bondswoman, who is even on a higher level than the Hebrew bondsman, she has less servitude. She goes free under many more circumstances. Her servitude is much more limited. And the way it describes is she is the inside person. She doesn't go out to the field at all. She's already in the home. And she takes the raw material and turns it into something that can be consumed, that can be eaten, that's something that's fit. So spiritually too, there's a process of transformation. And finally, the highest level is the daughter, the princess, the person who's not a bonds person at all, who doesn't have to do anything by force, but has a relationship with God because of inner feeling of oneness with God. And now, so I have the steps, one who has to climb up from the bottom up, but I also have the three arrows pointing down. And because on the other hand, even though one has to climb up, why would a person be interested in climbing up in the first place? What motivates this urge to grow, to climb, to get closer? And that's only because deep down, behind the scenes, we all have this level of the princess, the daughter, the child of God. We all have an innate bond with God anyway. And that has to suffuse all the other levels. So even a person who's starting off at the bottom is really not interested and is doing it just because of a guilty conscience and would rather be free and left alone. That person behind really is suffused on some level with a higher vision, with an innate oneness, an innate unity with God as a child is. So without that, the whole process doesn't even begin. Now, when I send the headings on the top here, if you go down towards the end, the second to last one, I speak about the Rebbe's innovation. Then when I say the Rebbe, if you look at the bottom of the page, this is adapted from a discourse and the subsequent talks by the seventh Rebbe. When I say the Rebbe, that's who I'm speaking about. my own Rebbe, this, Dr. Lonto pointed out before, whose photo is on the wall there, the seventh Rebbe of the Chabad Lubavitch dynasty. And what he actually gave a discourse in the early years of his tenure as Rebbe, based on this discussion of this theme as discussed by his predecessors in the first three generations. So he was number seven, but this discourse is actually based on generations 1, 2, and 3 of this theme. So when I say here, the Rebbe's innovation, I mean the seventh Rebbe. My Rebbe's innovation, he has a sense of taking what people think is the lowest and showing that it's really the highest, of flipping things on their head. And not in a negative sense, but a sort of subverting the hierarchies, which is what he does here too. We'll get to that soon. But so let's first start from the bottom up indeed. And I have, if we have time, which we probably won't, I have some more detail on this lowest level, Canaanite bondsman actually. And the very struggles and stages, and I think they actually spent most of their time on that level in their discourses, because really that's where most of us have to, I don't know, I don't want to say anything, present company excluded, I think that's where most of us have to start. We have to start at the bottom. Most of us are not already at the top. I can just speak for myself. So they probably put most time into that for that reason. So let's just run through the bottom stage. And we'll look at various categories, the type of person, and what that person's task or role or remit is, the psychological state of that person and the person's work towards and forging a relationship with God, the soul level, what this means, and according to the Kabbalistic Sfirot the Kabbalistic worlds, and how that actually applies in prayer, in the motive for Torah study, the motive for filling the action-oriented commandments. And then we'll look at the Rebbe's flip on all of this. And I just, for the sake of the wholeness, I included the mention of corresponding angels, although the Rebbe doesn't really develop that theme in his discourses. But for those of us who are into angels, we can actually see the corresponding angel to that level. So let's start at the bottom of the first chart, Canaanite bondsman. So what is his... remit, what is his agenda, what is his relationship with God? Forced action. He forces himself. He has this rod, this staff. And so he serves God, not because he's interested, not because he's really motivated from the inside. He himself would just prefer it, as the Talmud says, Avda behefkera naichalei. A slave prefers to just be left alone to do his own thing, not necessarily to be constructive, but due to the rod, the staff, which in most cases the Rebbe construes as a conscience, really, an inner staff, an inner rod, the person forces himself to enter into a relationship with God. Now, the level of soul that corresponds to this is what we call nefesh. There are different names for the soul, different stages of the soul. One called nefesh means basically that the thing exists, that the fact, the power to just make it be, with nothing more than that. And according to the Kabbalah, people may have heard of the 10 sefirot, the 10 sort of psychological elements that are the structure of creation. So in that map of the sefirot, these would be the lowest, or almost the lowest three sefirot. Netzach, Hod, and Yesod, which I translate here, perseverance. Netzach means to be victorious or to persevere, to soldier on even though it's difficult. Hod, which is interpreted in various ways, but in this context it would be interpreted Hod v'hoda'ah, which means accepting authority. And Yesod, which would be implementing. These are just practical, action-oriented psychological motivations. And in the four worlds that the Kabbalists describe based on a verse in Isaiah, the person functioning, when we function on this level, we're functioning in the reality of asiya, of actualization of external reality. And in our prayer life, we engage in this. The first thing we do when we wake up and we realize that we're awake, the first thing we say is, Moda ani lefanecha melechai v'kayam shechazarta bi nishmati v'chemla rabba emunatacha, which means, I acknowledge you, God. You don't even say the name God. He just says, I acknowledge you. or it can also be translated as think, but I think that acknowledge works better in this context. And also the beginning of the formal, more formal prayers is also with the same sort of word hodu, which is also the same word hoda'ah, acknowledging God. Hodu la Hashem kiru bishmo, acknowledge God, call upon His name. So we're very distant, we're not intimate with God yet. All we can do is acknowledge, say, we admit you're out there, you're right, we're wrong, or so that sort of thing, or we're sort of oblivious to you, but we recognize that you're really there and we really should be focused on you, and we're going to try to make a paradigm shift. And why does a person like that study the Torah? He doesn't do it because of the Torah's sake, because he appreciates Torah or anything like that. He does it for heteronomous reasons. There's something from the outside telling him this is what you have to do, so this is what he does. He doesn't appreciate it. He hasn't developed any appreciation for it in his interior. And the same thing is true for the commandments. He doesn't do them because they're worthy in and of themselves, or because he appreciates them, or he knows what they're supposed to accomplish. He does them because he's told to do them, so he does them. This is sort of the act of submission or admitting or acknowledging that he has to do what God wants, although he doesn't appreciate it. Now, here's the Rebbe's flip on this, his transformation, how he subverts this lowest thing, and he says it's really the highest. And although, yes, indeed, it's heteronymous, it's done not because of myself, it's done because some voice from the outside says, thou shall, whatever it is, do this, do that. But on the other hand, you're not doing it for any utilitarian reasons. You're not doing the commandments because you appreciate their social impact and how they structure society in a good way, or because you enjoy them, which are all external and utilitarian and non-essential factors. You are doing them with simplistic dedication to God, which means, in a way, you are more attuned to the true essence of these commandments than someone who's higher than you. Someone who's higher than you appreciates them in an aesthetic way, maybe, or in a political way, or in a internal way. It says, yes, I like these things. I appreciate them. They make sense to me. I see what they accomplish. And that's really not a true dedication. That's done as you're dedicated to yourself. You're dedicated to your sense of aesthetics. You're not really dedicated to the higher purpose. But in this case, the heteronomy plus the simple accepting things with simplicity, just because God said, and I'm going to do it, that really opens a person up to something bigger. That opens a door, that opens really the entire relationship to be set out not limited by your own predilections, but you're really open to God as God. It opens up a whole new space psychologically. And that also enables us, when we have that relationship with God, to really carry out what God's agenda is, so to speak, which is to take that which is lowest and discover God even there. Say, yes, we're not interested, we're not motivated, and even here, even in that total being sunk in the self, I'm going to discover God, I'm going to bring God's presence even into that, even into my non-interest, that everything has to be done from the outside. I will transform that and use that as an ultimate act of dedication to God. So the lowest becomes the highest to such a degree that eventually a person can experience an utter oneness and a total oneness with God, specifically because he let go of his own agenda. He doesn't have, and he's not doing these commandments for aesthetic reasons or his own appreciation. So that really opens up something new inside of the person. Okay, so moving up from there to the level of the Hebrew bondsman, who I said mediates between the inside and the outside, we are entering into new dimension in relationship with God. No longer just doing it out of forced action. We're now engaging with God because we are emotionally engaged. Something opened up in us. We made space for God at stage number one, and things started happening, things started percolating inside of the person, and now, all of a sudden, we started feeling, we started appreciating. So we actually removed ourselves. We transposed ourselves. We picked ourselves up from being utterly disinterested and oblivious, and we now entered into a whole new space, into a whole new realm, into the realm of holiness, into the realm of communion with God, of it being in the presence of God. However, although we entered into a new space, we still remain the same people that we were before. So it didn't penetrate us internally. We just changed space, but we didn't transform on the inside yet. And the reason is, moving on to the next column, because what happens? A person has to do internal work, has to contemplate to make this paradigm shift. So indeed, the person here is contemplating. He's recognizing, yes, there is a creator. I'm not self-sufficient. I didn't create myself. I didn't bring myself into being. There's an underlying reality. But we're just laying out the chapter headings. We're not deeply delving into this subject matter. It's more as an emotional experience. We're not being true intellectuals yet. We're not letting go of everything and abandoning ourselves to the concept, to the idea, and letting it take over in our lives. We're remaining ourselves and we're appreciating a concept. We're saying that's touching, that's moving, that's beautiful, that sort of thing. And when we're functioning on that level in our relationship with God, we're on the level of ruach. The five levels of the soul, the level of ruach is one step up beyond basic existence, that I'm spirited, I have emotion in my relationship with God. And that brings us into the level of what we call chesed, gvura, tiferet, the higher emotional sphere, loving kindness, power, beauty. We start experiencing our relationship with God through these, God's power, our own power to be open to God's power. This is in the worlds, in terms of the worlds, this is a step up. There's a world called Yetzirah, where we're speaking about the form of things rather than the actualized external reality. And when do we do this in the morning prayers? From Baruch Shamar, which means blessed is the one who spoke and the world came into being, which itself is a message to us as a paradigm shift, to look at the world not as a fact that's there, but look at it as divine speech. It's sort of up for question. Does it exist? Does it not exist? It's just really an expression of divine creativity. And it's not as solid as we think it is. So thinking about that, all the way through the verses of praise from the end of Psalms, etc., and various songs that are included in the Bible. And as far as our engagement with Torah on this level, we would be engaging in Torah not by force, not because they're not interested in it, but we'd be doing it because we want to attach ourselves to God. We know that Torah has some greatness in it, has divine wisdom in it, and we want to tap into that. We want to lift ourselves up thereby. And the same thing with doing the commandments, the action-oriented commandments. We know that there's a great good for ourselves and for society in these commandments, so we want to open up to that. And now the Rebbe, as I said, the seventh Rebbe inverts all of this, and he says, yes, there is an appreciation here for Torah and commandments, but it's not really, we're not open to Torah and commandments in their pure, essential dimension. We're taking Torah and commandments and refracting them of what they do for us, what they do for me. Instead of being open to God's thing on God's level, we're open to God's thing on our level. So what does God's Torah say for me in a way that I can appreciate it, in a way that I can enjoy it? What do the commandments do for my life? Instead of saying, what are these things in and of themselves beyond my appreciation, beyond my capacity? Can it take me, lift me into something bigger? Or even, should I even be thinking what it does for me? Or should I think about what is the thing in and of itself? So that lifts us up to the next stage. The Hebrew bonds woman was on the inside. This represents, in relationship to God, when a person engages in intensive intellectual effort that actually changes the inner self. So before, a person moved into the divine space, into sacred space, made a shift, but I said there wasn't serious contemplation, so the change didn't, the self wasn't changed. The self was just exposed to new ideas, new space, new intellectual space. But here, the person does intensive contemplation and abandons himself to the concepts. And instead of filtering concepts through your emotional disposition, through your aesthetic sense, you let go of yourself entirely and sort of totally give yourself to engage in these concepts, and whatever happens, happens. And whatever, and then see your emotions are, new emotions are created through this. A new self is really developed through that engagement. And this is called engaging God on the level of neshama, which is an intellectual level. And this corresponds to the sphirot, the divine sphirot, and the human sphirot of chokhma, bina, and dat, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, and the world of bria, creation, the inception of self-awareness. There's no form yet. There's certainly nothing actualized yet. It's just a possibility of being a self. And we get to that in our morning prayers when we say the Shema. Hear, O Israel, or listen, O Israel. The Lord is our God. The Lord is one. And the blessings that accompany that, we're sort of stepping out of ourselves into hearing and to listening, contemplation, as Hear, O Israel, Shema. And we're contemplating, we're listening that there is an ultimate unity, an ultimate oneness. And instead of appreciating it from the outside, we're trying to actually let that penetrate us. And there a person studies Torah, not because we're forced to, and not even because of what it does for ourselves personally, but we're studying Torah because the Torah we realize is just the flow of divinity. So what we're trying to do, the Torah as we know it, is already, let's say, is a fixed datum. We have words, but there's this idea in Judaism, in the mystical Judaism at least, that the words can take infinite levels of meaning, infinite layers of meaning. So what we're trying to do is we're saying, up until this point, in God's relationship with us, with the world, with the creation, the Torah has had a certain amount of meaning. And what we're trying to do now is reach to God's essence and draw new and deeper meaning down into the, through these same words, into the Torah, and bring God into the world, into our reality, into the creation in a new way. And as a result of that, in addition to other things, God will actually interact and relate to the world, maybe in a more compassionate way, in a new way, in a different way. So we touch God's essence, and we bring that essence refracted through the Torah, which is God's judgment, God's wisdom for the world, and we bring out deeper new wisdom in God's relationship with the world. So this is a very lofty goal of Torah study. And also in the fulfillment of the commandments, there's a theurgic motivation. We want to act on God. We perform the commandments, and through that, we get God to do the commandments. It says God is not a hypocrite. God tells us to do commandments, but God is willing. Well, this spins in two ways, but the way I'll describe it here, God will do what God tells us to do. If we do it, God also will do it. For example, if we put tefillin on, and in tefillin it says, Shema Yisrael, listen, and it speaks about the greatness of God, and we have that on our minds and on our hearts, God will do the same thing. But what is written in God's tefillin? In God's tefillin it says, who is like the people of Israel? So like that, so we bring God into our mind and our heart, and then that God will bring us into his mind and his heart. So this idea of having a new flow, a new engagement with God through our doing the practical commandments too. And again, the shortcoming here, the seventh Rebbe he inverts everything, and he says, yes, these are very lofty and beautiful intentions, but they're still utilitarian goals in engagement with the Torah. It's not the ultimate, not Torah for its own sake, not commandments for their own sake. And then finally we get to the daughter, the princess, the child of God. Now the question, how can you get higher than intellectual engagement with God to such a degree that you abandon yourself to the contemplation and you reconstruct yourself? Well, there's one step higher. You let go of yourself entirely. You merge into the one quintessential point, the oneness of God. So instead of being a separate individual that understands on the higher level that we just discussed, or feels two levels down, or forces oneself, you're not a separate individual at all. Your whole consciousness, your whole being is seen as just a function within the divine reality. Instead of being a separate, individuated person, you look at yourself from the way you're seen up from upon high, from God's perspective, that the higher reality is real. And what's below, that's not the ultimate reality to you. This is the psychological state at work here is that little spark inside of us of being a child, being innately connected, being, so to speak, everyone has a little spark of Moses on the inside, trying to bring out that interiority where we and God are not two separate things. We're part of that oneness. The soul levels here are the levels of Chaya and Yechida. These are inner transcendent levels. They go beyond interpretation, beyond emotional reaction, beyond force. The spheras, although not discussed in this discourse, Keter, the crown that's above the head, above the mind, something bigger, something transcendent. The world, in Kabbalistic terms that corresponds to this, is the world of Atzilut, emanation, a world in where everything exists, but it exists as divinity, as divine emanation, rather than separate created things. And we try to reach this every single day, every morning when we do the silent prayer, the standing prayer, the Amidah, especially when we bow down. And when we say Sim Shalom, at the final stage, when we say bring wholeness or peace to the world, and when we bow down, we're sort of letting go of ourselves and entering into that oneness. And here, the reason for doing the commandments are not exterior, they're not utilitarian. They're done because we have reached the point where we and God resonate because we're not separate from God anymore. And we're able to appreciate the inner reality of the commandments beyond any utilitarian aspects of them. And so we are resonating with God's inner purpose. So in the earlier discourses, as I said, this was the ultimate height. And interestingly enough, in the seventh Rebbe's discourse, although that has to suffuse all the lower levels, the greatest height is actually attained in the lowest level. Only sort of, I guess, when suffused with that highest level. So, but it comes back. There's something ultimate. Although, yes, in the two middle levels, where one appreciates emotionally or intellectually, there may be ulterior utilitarian motives. And in the highest and lowest levels, things are done for their purest motives. One because you're there, and the other because you let go, you're sort of forcing yourself from the outside. And indeed, that highest level has to suffuse everything for the whole process to work. But again, according to the seventh Rebbe, there is something very special, very ultimate about the dedication that comes out on that lowest level when one has to use force. Now, please tell me how much overtime I am. 3 minutes overtime?
Three more minutes.
Okay. So maybe we'll look at some of the charts that actually deal with that lowest level and the range of possibilities that's open. This is page 3 of the handout. Now, this is based on the second generation of this dynasty, the Chabad dynasty. The range of levels within the Canaanite bondsman, this lowest person on the lowest level, how much can he actually do? And some of us, although maybe we during prayer we raise ourselves up, but during the course of the day we're basically on this level of the Canaanite bondsman, although we have our moments of illumination. But we can actually function on this very lofty level called in the Tanya and in the seminal book of Chabad thought, we can function on the level of a Beinoni. What is a Beinoni? It means an intermediate person. What is intermediate? It means that we look at two things, behavioral aspects and internal aspects. A Beinoni behaviorally is a perfect person, but internally is still a struggling person. So this person never does a transgression. He never transgresses any commandments whatsoever. He doesn't even, when a forbidden thought enters his mind, without unconsciously, the minute he becomes conscious of it, he expels the thought. And there are certain things that are permitted. For example, kosher food. But even when it comes to kosher things, he won't immerse himself in sensual pleasures, even when the objects are kosher. So a bondsman is able, on that lowest level, is still able to raise himself through the rod, so to speak, of conscience, is able to raise himself to this very lofty level and is able to function on this very great level. There are lower levels as well. A person transgresses only occasionally, and also never do a wrong action or say a wrong thing, but maybe would entertain inappropriate thoughts. That means the person has, so the fear of the rod, which is a conscience, is not strong enough to overcome the occasional inappropriate thought, but the person will say, oh, I shouldn't have done that, I won't do it again. step down, a person maybe transgresses even more, but will do full repentance, will feel the rod again in the sense of guilt and say, I shouldn't have done that. But yes, a person does sincere full repentance for now, but you never know what's going to happen next week. Next week you may be back to the same, and then the stage down from there, the wicked are full of regrets. A person feels, oh, I shouldn't be doing this, but you do it anyway. That means that you have their bad and your good are conflicted inside of you, but the good is not strong enough, but it still has a voice. Then the stage down from there, a person doesn't even feel regret. The good is not even discernible. But when an external rod comes along, a person goes through hard times in life, physical suffering, etc., that can bring a person to turn around, to come back to God. Some people will never become aroused, because that little bit of good that we all have, that little bit of Moses, that little bit of being the daughter of the king, although present, is something outside. It's like a voice from outside of us. And it's not internalized enough. They're not internalized at all, so it doesn't actually do anything to us. So I guess the trick, or not the trick, or the struggle is to become aware that of the challenge, become aware of the issue, and become aware that we all have that inner voice, that voice of goodness. We all are really the child of God. And even though we may be functioning as a Canaanite bondsman on the outside, we really deep down have that voice of the voice of God. We are really the child of God, and to use that to open up so we can actually climb through these stages and bring together the highest and the lowest going through the stages in between. And with that, I will say thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We've taken just a few questions.
If there are any. Yes.
Two great movements in the 18th, 19th century were the Hasidic movement and the Musa movement. So there's a Hasidic characterization of the difference between them, that the Musa movement focuses on the bad and says how we have to get away from the bad. And the Hasidic movement focuses on the light, on the good, and says we have to run towards the good. Now, it seems to me this is a Hasidic text which uses a Musa method. Like, it's highlighting the problem of this Tanana bondsman inside us, so that we should sort of get up and do something about it. Could you comment on that?
I think that your comment says everything. That indeed it is a Hasidic text, in that it tells us that really behind the scenes we have that good voice. We are really the daughter of the king. We're really the princess. But it does have Musar elements in it, in that it tells you there are real problems that have to be dealt with. So indeed, I think your comment that, you know, the saving grace or element that makes it Hasidic is telling you that you really have the ultimate inside of you, number one. And what the seventh Rebbe does, it says in the lowest, they're actually the highest is actually present in the lowest anyway. So yes, but be cognizant that it takes a lot of work. No free rides. And there's a lot of self-transformation that has to go into the process. And you should be aware of the challenges that are there.
Yes. Could you maybe, I mean, this is a transformative text. Like, the person, it seems to me, is supposed to learn this teaching that you have so beautifully presented, and then apply it in their life, and especially in prayer. So that if they do this during the morning prayer, which is where it's addressed, they actually come out transformed at the end. Could you maybe put that a little bit in context, like Talmudic approaches to prayer, medieval approaches to prayer, Kabbalistic approaches?
Well, this comes back to your talk, actually, to contextualize. You were speaking about individualism, and I think this is certainly this sort of prayer which is contemplative prayer, where a person actually goes through, I wonder even if it's conducive to communal prayer. Classically, in Jewish law, prayer is supposed to be done, especially by men, is supposed to be done in a quorum of 10. And you should sort of regulate your own prayer so you keep up with the other 9 people with whom you're praying. And so this sort of militates in the other direction. It's really an individualistic sort of, the same form of prayer, the same traditional blessings, but with the whole Kabbalistic layer read into them, where a person actually, and the Hasidic layer will be that the Kabbalah becomes psychologized, and the person actually takes his journey psychologically through these stages. It may take several hours. Especially the contemplation before and during, especially in stage 3, where you're not just laying the concepts out and looking at the chapter headings, but you're actually abandoning yourself to enter in those concepts and let them take over inside of you. Yes, that's I think I would answer by pointing back to the tension raised in your talk just before.
I just have a brief point. I mean, first of all, the idea of contemplative prayer must have been also with the early sages, the humble sages, who prayed many hours, and they talk about praying the whole day and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, second point is bondswoman. So he has a princess, which it must relate to Benot Zion. Sometimes the Jews are called the daughter of Zion, the daughter princess. But then you have other terminologies of sister and mother. Just wondering if bondsman and bondswoman connects with, and sometimes Solomon refers to the Jewish people as sister.
I'm not even sure
if any parallels.
I'm not sure if, I don't think here the princess is picking up on that. I think the princess is more, I'd have to look into it further, but what struck me here is that the two higher levels or layers are female, which is an interesting, and the female here is associated with intense intellectual effort here, which I found that striking in this discourse. And I was wondering if anyone would raise that, but no one did. But usually one, they won't expect, oh, the female will be somewhere at the bottom and the male would be the intellectual. But here it's actually, it's sort of the other way around. But I don't think that the princess, I think it's more Zoharic. I think it's more the Mokoyan out of the Zohar here. And that where the Zohar, you know, where that context comes from, I'd have to do a little bit more research to see if it links back.
There is a passage in Tikkuni Zohar which speaks of the princess.
Yeah.
That is as the divine. That's, and here, the princess is the individual.
Yeah, so it's already maybe, reworking that could be.
And it's very interesting in Rabbi Nachman of Rassab's famous story, The Lost Princess, where a princess is lost, and the hero of the story is looking for her, searching for her all over the world. And then, is the princess the divine presence? Is it one's own soul?
Well, I mentioned before, which is made famous by Gershom Scholem, the idea that Hasidism is actually, it takes the divine map of Kabbalah and it makes it psychological in the individual. So it fits, actually, that the princess here is now, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Thank you.
Would like it to welcome the final talk for today, which I've been waiting for the whole day, whole afternoon. Yeah, we got handouts. Yep.
Yeah.